You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a proposed bill in the House of Representatives could make Election Day a federal holiday if passed, but some lawmakers say it's a political stunt and a power grab. We'll learn more in a bit and take your calls. First, if you've ever felt burnout in your life, it was maybe time for a break or a change. Maybe you needed a vacation or a career move or someone to watch the kids for a bit, whatever it might be. But our next guest says many millennials are experiencing burnout as a way of life, and it's not something that can be fixed as easily as a vacation or a minor life change. Anne Helen Peterson is a senior culture writer and Western correspondent for BuzzFeed News. She wrote the piece, How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation. Anne, thanks for joining us.
So happy to be here.
Well, millennials, and that's generally, we're talking about people from 22 to 38 right about now, as I understand it, feeling a lot of burnout. Anne, how are you seeing that? What kind of forms is it taking for people?
Well, I think the real revelation when I was writing the piece is that it doesn't manifest in the way that we necessarily think of burnout traditionally, which is like, oh my gosh, I'm so worn out. I'm so tired. I need to like go to the beach for a week and somehow I'll recover. More for, I think, a lot of millennials working in the current landscape of jobs, like it is something that you work through, that you just live with, like it is our base temperature. And it involves just kind of this flattening where it feels like everything that you do in your life is part of this endless to-do list and there's no joy to any of it.
And a lot of the examples you give from your own life and things you heard from others, it can make what might look like a routine task look overwhelming just in the scope of everything else that's going on.
Yeah. So the word that I use for it, which is kind of like a funny word or funny phrase, is called errand paralysis, because I was trying to figure out, you know, why couldn't I do these very simple tasks in my life? Things like picking up the dry cleaning. And everyone has something different on that list. You know, a lot of people, I think of it as like the bottom half of your to-do list, the things that keep getting rolled over week after week. And a lot of it is just that, like, you can't, you create these mechanisms in your life that you're focusing so much on your job and on giving all of your energy to your job that these other things that seem to have low payout, low benefit, just get ignored.
Let's start to look at some of the reasons that are behind this. And you just mentioned the attention to the job, the constant availability to the job, whatever it might be, thanks to social media and our phones. People are, they're never not working in some ways is what you're seeing.
Yeah, you know, in the piece I talk about how the last time that I really didn't feel burnout was when I was working as a nanny. And that was right after I graduated from college. I was in, it was around like 2003 to 2005. And I just had like a dorky flip phone, you know, I didn't even text people, but I also had this very clear on and off of the job. So I would show up at 8 o'clock and I would leave the house at 6, and there was nothing that I had to do for my job in the off hours. Whereas now I can be doing my job at all times, you know, on my phone, checking email, doing Slack, which is this, you know, communication tool for the workplace that people have on their phones.
And people, I think, give millennials a hard time for being on social media a lot, for being connected, for things that don't necessarily look like job reasons. But, and I think you wrote about this, a lot of time on social media is, in some cases, maybe building a brand, performing for a potential future employer, even if you're not directly doing your job right now.
Yeah. So the contemporary resume in a lot of the work that millennials do, it's much more than a sheet of paper. It's your whole digital footprint. And that means like what your Instagram account looks like, what your LinkedIn account looks like, all of these different things that you post or that you write about or that you perform in some way that come together to form like your brand as a worker. And that's really difficult to understand if you have not tried to get a job in like the more contemporary, sometimes it's called knowledge work, workplace. And so I think that's oftentimes why there's this feeling that millennials are lazy. It's like, why are you posting to Instagram? But that really is, for a lot of millennials, that is part of their work.
Talking to Anne Helen Peterson from BuzzFeed News, talking about the piece she wrote there, How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation. And underlying all of this is this sense of economic precariousness, especially after the great recession that started in about 2008. Can you talk about how that's just looming in the background here?
Yeah, most millennials have never been in a job marketplace that hasn't been defined by the economic downturn. So, you know, for some of us, that means that when we graduated college, we entered straight into it and, you know, lack of jobs or even entry level jobs were being taken by people with much more experience. So there just wasn't really a place. And the suggestion that a lot of us internalized was go back to grad school. And so we did. And then when we emerged from grad school, a year, 2 years, 4 years, 6 years later, the job market still had not completely recovered. And we had all the student loan debt that we accumulated during that time.
I want to bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Ellen is with us in Milwaukee. Ellen, hi. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, hi. I'm so glad to your guest that she's written this article. I feel very strongly that millennials do not deserve the bad reputation. And my reasoning comes from an up-close view of my own daughter, who's a millennial. When she was working here in Milwaukee at various, in the food industry, she was always working. Now that she's in Oakland, California, and managing a small restaurant, she'll get home at 1 or 2 in the morning, get up at 9, and be gone by 11. And that is her work week, except for one day a week. And when I've gone out there, I get 2 hours to see her in a day. You know, it's just incredible to me. Many other people in her generation work like that.
And how is she feeling amidst all of this, Ellen?
She puts her nose to the grindstone, but she has begun to use antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication.
Ellen, thank you so much for sharing her story. Best to your daughter. And Ellen's daughter is not alone. A lot of people are, I guess, having these symptoms of millennial life and having to medicate to deal with them.
Yeah, you know, a lot of that anxiety really results from being in this environment of economic precarity. Like the job schedule that the caller just described is very typical for a lot of millennials who are cobbling together several jobs. You know, we call it oftentimes like, I have my main hustle and my side hustle. And like, that's not, you know, necessarily a brand new thing. Like people have had side gigs for a long time. But the other thing too, is that there, you know, a lot of the jobs that we have, they're not what are sometimes called good jobs. And by a good job, you mean a job with a solid schedule, like a schedule you can predict for the next week so that you can do things like schedule childcare, a job that has not only just like 401k, but even just, you know, benefits like healthcare. And without those things, it just, you accumulate all of this worry. Like you are worrying all the time. I hope I don't get sick. I hope that I can figure out someone to take care of my kids. Like that, it builds on itself over time and contributes to this overarching feeling of burnout.
We're talking to Anne Helen Peterson, senior culture writer and Western correspondent for BuzzFeed News. We're talking about her piece, How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Is this your story? If you're a millennial, do you feel like you're experiencing this kind of burnout that our guest is describing? Where does that come from? What do you try to do about it? If you're not a millennial looking at it from the outside, do you see maybe parallels with your own experience? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation on burnout among millennials. Anne Helen Peterson is with us from BuzzFeed News, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see this kind of burnout as a millennial, maybe yourself, among yourself and your peers? You see it looking in from other generations, or are you feeling it whatever generation you're in? Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Back to your calls now. Daryl is with us in Germantown. Daryl, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm not a millennial. I'm 65 years old, and I also have two jobs going on. This is just a part of the way the economics of the world is right now. The sustainable wages just don't exist anymore in the workforce. So older people, younger people, whatever you want to call them, most of us have two jobs going on, and that's life right now.
Daryl, how are you feeling about that? Do you feel overwhelmed by this?
No, I don't. I feel fortunate that I have the skills to work and earn a living. And I don't have time to complain about it. I just go ahead and do what you need to do.
All right, Daryl, thanks for calling in. So, Daryl has the same economic reality, he says, but doesn't complain.
Yeah, I think that one thing that I've talked to a lot of people about is that there are so many parts of this experience that are, you know, things that have other people have experienced for a long time, or, you know, they're not limited specifically to millennials. What is unique about this particular generation, and obviously people on either side of it feel this as well, is that all of these things have consolidated at once. So the way I think of it's three things, right? It's like the economic precarity, so specifically never having a workforce that has been anything other than the current one that we have right now, right? The second is the student loan debt, which is, you know, astronomical compared to previous generations, when it was just a different scenario in terms of the cost of college, but also the ability to work your way through college and not emerge without debt. And then the third is really this need or the pressures of social media. And I mean that not in like a simplistic or like, oh, I need to be checking my Facebook account all the time. It's more that there is this pressure to feel like you are always living a life where things are balanced and put together, as well as the things that I was talking about earlier in terms of constant availability to your workplace.
Daryl, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Jennifer with us in northern Wisconsin. Jennifer, hi.
Hi. I'm a Gen Xer, the quiet, silent generation. And I think all of us in Gen X, or many of us, also have a main hustle and a side hustle and a side hustle. And I'm raising three teenagers as well. And I'm just wondering if the difference between the millennials' experience and the Gen X experience is that it is much more on a public forum, and you've created a different language for the type of burnout and type of jobs and type of lifestyle. And I'm just wondering how those two generations might compare in your research.
Jennifer, thanks for the call. Anne?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of Gen Xers really, especially depending where you are in the generation. So, you know, just because you were born in 1979 doesn't mean that you didn't experience a lot of the things that someone born in 1981 experienced. So that bumper generation feels a lot of similar things. Same for, you know, a lot of people I know who went into grad school in the early 2000s and then didn't actually enter the job force until the the recession. Like, they are effectively, in terms of their lifetimes as workers, they're effectively millennials, even though they might be grouped with Gen X. But again, I think that a lot of these things, like, most millennials have never had an adulthood that hasn't been mediated through social media. Like, that is it's a different thing, and it accumulates differently. And like, I'm not saying, again, like, I'm not trying to diminish the feelings that other generations have, but this is just the one that it accumulates around this particular generation.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Adam with us in Atoma. Adam, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Adam?
Well, I hear what you're saying. I definitely feel it. I got a full-time job and a business that you run on the side, and a family, and it seems the more successful I become, the more weight's even on me as it goes along.
Are you a millennial yourself, Adam?
Yes, I am.
Adam, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing that. So even as Adam feels himself maybe being more successful, he feels the pressure growing even to maintain that, Anne. Anne, are you there?
Yeah. I think that, like, there is this feeling, you know, this is one of the things, too, about millennials, is that we've been told for most of our adult lives that we're lazy or that we're children or that we're easily distracted. And so that's part of the burnout feeling, too, is this complete disconnect between how we are represented, oftentimes in writing or in depictions authored by different generations, oftentimes boomers or Gen Xers, and contrasting that with the way that we feel, which is that we are constantly working without rest.
Thanks for calling in, Adam. We're talking to Anne Helen Peterson from BuzzFeed News, talking about her piece on millennials and burnout. And I wanted to get into the idea of self-care. There's a lot of talk about this on social media and elsewhere, all these little ways and life hacks and things like that, that we can care for ourselves and get away from this kind of burnout. What do you see out there?
Yeah, I think that there was this feeling, like, self-care really became a popular phrase within the last 2 years. And a lot of how it's commonly used now is like, I deserve that massage, or like, I deserve that expensive facial cream or that sort of thing. Like, I should take time for that. But one thing that I've noticed is a lot of people feel like self-care is just one more thing on that to-do list that they need to do. For me, or another way to optimize themselves, like, this is the other thing about the particulars of millennial burnout, is there's this pressure to always optimize every experience. And so, like, okay, you got to optimize your skin. Like, how can you make your skin better using all of these different things that you can buy online? And I just feel like I'm failing, or that I need more things to buy online, and it doesn't actually feel fulfilling, or like I'm actually taking care of myself in any meaningful way.
And it seems like there's a temptation to want, and I feel this too, not a millennial myself, but to optimize our slack time. Okay, if I'm going to relax, I'm going to make sure I get as relaxed as I possibly can and make the most of it. It's a lot of pressure on relaxing.
Right, or that you Instagram a picture of the book that you're reading while you're relaxing, right? Like, it has to, your leisure time must also be documented.
Now, you also put up a piece, not just the one you wrote about millennial burnout itself, but you got a lot of responses from people from different walks of life. And, you know, you can't have like a one size fits all for millennials or any generation. What kind of varieties of experience did you hear from your readers about?
Well, one thing that's really interesting about this piece is that oftentimes when, like, a white person describes a phenomenon, that's when it becomes a common understanding, right? So, like, I wrote this piece, and then people are like, oh yeah, millennial burnout. When a lot of people responded to me, they're like, you know, I'm a Black woman in America. I was born burnt out. Like, you know, this is the history that my family has carried with us. And so I've been very mindful of that, just trying to amplify voices, but also just spending a lot of time listening. So whether it's people of color, people who are first generation immigrants, disabled people, there are so many different ways that burnout accumulates differently for them.
Let's take another caller now. John is with us in Madison. John, hello.
Hi. I'd like to say if any other generations are having trouble understanding why millennials are so burnt out, they should try giving away their life savings, giving away their retirement benefits. Start from scratch with like $100, but like $30,000 in student loans. Try looking for an apartment and looking for a job in that situation, and you'll quickly find out why so many millennials were attracted to Bernie Sanders with a promise of, you know, reduced college tuition or no college tuition, and, you know, free health care for everybody.
John, thanks for the call. A couple points there, and let's tackle actually the second half of what he had to say. Anne, you write that, okay, there's self-care and individual ways to deal with burnout. You say there's something bigger needed.
Yeah, I think that we have to change our relationship to labor. You know, I think there was this understanding that if we could just work more, right? The promise is like, if we become more efficient, then actually we would be able to work less, right? That, like, we would get more done in less amount of time. That's not how it's worked out. Instead, we work more for more hours and we're more exhausted. And so I think this is one of the reasons why younger people, especially millennials, are really attracted to unions again, after a period of maybe believing that they weren't as necessary. Same thing with democratic socialism. Like, if you identify our relationship to labor as the problem, then someone like Bernie Sanders or AOC is going to be very appealing.
John, thanks a lot for the call. And in our last couple minutes, do you think that having written this and gotten it out there and heard back from other people maybe in the same situation, has that, I don't know, started to clarify your thinking about this nagging burnout that you kind of knew was there but didn't have a name for yet?
Yeah, I think, a lot of the things that I described of being impossible for me in the first part of the article, writing it liberated me from the shame and allowed me to actually just get it done. Like, I made all these appointments, you know, I dropped off my shoes at the cobbler. And the number of people who have emailed me to say similar things is really startling. And, the phrase that millennials sometimes use is, I felt seen. And what that means is that the article articulated something about you that you feel like, you know, the rest of society, your close friends and family maybe don't understand. And so my hope is that now that we have more language to talk about this feeling, that we can actually do something with that.
We'll leave it there for now. Anne, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Anne Helen Peterson is a senior culture writer and Western correspondent for BuzzFeed News. She joins to talk about her piece, How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation. Coming up, Election Day could become a federal holiday under legislation proposed in Congress. Not all lawmakers support the bill. We'll learn why after the news. And you can tell us what you think. You can email now, ideas@WPR.org. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Should Election Day be a holiday? Federal? State? Should businesses allow more time off? And so on. Let us know what you think. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, join Kate Archer-Kent and her guest for a look at tonight's State of the Union address and the Democratic response. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, a new anti-corruption bill introduced by House Democrats tackles, among many things, the way Americans vote. Among the proposed changes, people would be able to register to vote online, and states could automatically register eligible voters. One provision that's caught a lot of people's attention involves a proposal that would make Election Day a federal holiday. The goal, according to Democrats, is to allow more people to be able to miss work without losing pay. The hope, too, is that private businesses would follow suit. Not all lawmakers support the measure. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced that the likelihood the bill would move, let alone pass, was slim. And he said that the bill is nothing more than a power grab by Democrats. Philip Chen is an assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. Philip, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
All right, this idea of making Election Day a federal holiday, part of this big bill. But people have talked about this on and off over the years for a long time, right? What would be involved in making Election Day a federal holiday?
Well, truthfully, what's involved is simply passing the bill. It has been talked about a lot, but it does not. If they wanted to move the day from the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, that would require a constitutional amendment. But just making the day a federal holiday simply requires an act of Congress.
Now, making something a federal holiday doesn't seem like it would necessarily have that much impact. It means federal employees, most of them get the day off. Is that something that makes a big difference?
I think it depends on what you mean by makes a big difference. Mm-hmm. I think it sends an important signal about the value of participation in voting in the country. That being said, you're right. On its face, the only companies that are required to give the day off are not companies at all. They are the federal government. But as you alluded to, many companies will probably follow suit. I mean, we can think about federal holidays that have many people who have that day off.
Now, there are state laws, different state laws all over the country on whether private employees get paid time off, unpaid time off, whatever, on election day. It's a patchwork, right?
Correct. It is. I believe the count is around in the high 30s of states that have some form of law allowing people to take some time off. But again, paid time off is fairly rare. Often it's that you are allowed to take unpaid time off, provide, and we cannot be punished by your employer. So there's a series of laws that are in place, as you said, patchwork. There isn't really a consistency across states.
Among the reasons that we don't necessarily have high voter turnout in the United States, where does this fit in? This idea that, okay, maybe people can't get away from work to vote.
You know, it's hard to isolate any one effect. We have a lot of reasons why we have lower voter turnout in the United States. I think what you'll find is that the thing that we see as political scientists that drives people away from voting is what we call the sort of broadly termed the costs of voting. And these don't have to be economic costs. They can be sort of informational costs, the time needed to learn, the cost of finding childcare, the cost of finding time off of work. All of these things can be both economic costs or informational costs. And so this is just removing one barrier, one of those sources of costs. So, you know, we don't have good evidence yet as to what the specific effect of this one provision would be. But suffice it to say, it would likely not decrease voter turnout.
Now, how do our peers in the developed world compare to us when it comes to election day being something more like a holiday?
We're pretty much the anomaly. Most countries in the developed world, they tend to vote on weekends, so Saturdays or Sundays, or extended time over the, that time, or they'll have election day be a national holiday. If you look at the list of developed democratic countries, most of them vote on the weekends or vote over an extended period of time. That's another option that has been discussed.
Talking to Philip Chen from Beloit College, looking at a proposed change to federal law making Election Day a federal holiday and other ways maybe to encourage voter turnout. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell not on board with the idea of an Election Day holiday. He said the proposal wouldn't go anywhere. And he talked about what he thought the intentions were from Democrats. Here he is speaking on the Senate floor.
Just what America needs, another paid holiday and a bunch of government workers being paid to go out and work. I assume our folks on, our colleagues on the other side, on their campaigns. This is the Democrat plan to restore democracy? A brand new week of paid vacation for every federal employee who'd like to hover around while you cast your ballot? A Washington-based, taxpayer-subsidized clearinghouse for political campaign funding? A power grab that's smelling more and more like exactly what it is.
So Majority Leader McConnell making the case that this change and the others Democrats proposed are for the benefit exclusively of Democrats.
I mean, so he's probably right. What we know is that he's probably not right about a Democratic power grab, as you said, that the federal workforce is a fairly small percentage of the total population anyway. But he's right that federal workers do tend to vote Democratic. But you sort of have to separate out the political from the sort of intent of expanding access to voting. And I think that's where people are, politicians are getting tripped up, or not necessarily tripped up, but are talking past each other. You see McConnell saying this is about a Democratic power grab, about wanting to get more Democrats, more Democratic volunteers out for their campaigns. And you have Democrats on the other side saying this is about access to voting. These are two different arguments, actually about two different issues.
Would the symbolic value of declaring this a federal holiday, do you think it would trickle down to states passing similar legislation, to businesses getting on hand? Would a change in this law add some more oomph, some more respect to Election Day?
So I think what we'd see is, one, the states would not need to pass a subsequent law. I mean, they could declare it a state holiday as well to guarantee state workers time off, though most state workers also, or states give federal holidays off. because of national supremacy, the national law is going to hold. I do think you'd probably see some businesses follow suit, but we're already seeing some businesses take the lead on this. The question is, of course, is whether this becomes a politicized issue and you see companies starting to polarize based on their politics or the politics of their workers along these lines.
Now, if somebody came to you and said, Philip, hey, we want to make voting more accessible. We want to make it easier for people to vote. What would be your first strategies to do that?
My first strategy would probably be universal voting or universal registration. So an automatic registration. It would probably, I think that Election Day as a holiday would be part of that. And it would be, it has to be a suite of proposals. Any one of these in isolation is unlikely to have any particularly strong effect. But I think, yes, giving people time off, giving people especially paid time off, and then creating the incentive for people to be registered. And there's other things we could do as far as making the information more available about candidates. But those are kind of a longer list of things that might be a little bit more controversial.
We're talking to Philip Chen right now, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. He's with us to talk about how practical it would be for Election Day to be a federal holiday and the politics that could play a role in whether or not that happens. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Election Day be a holiday? What do you think of the politics surrounding this proposal right now from House Democrats? Do you think the government should do things to make voting easier, or is it easy enough as it is? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about how establishing Election Day as a federal holiday could impact voting and why some lawmakers are pushing back against this proposed reform. Our guest is Philip Chen. He's an assistant professor of political science at Beloit College, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Should Election Day be a federal holiday? Should people get paid time off to vote? What do you think would make voting more accessible? What would bring voter turnout up in the United States? Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. To your calls now, Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Voting, I consider one of the greatest privileges of living in this country, and we need to be informed in voters so that we can elect the appropriate leaders for our country. To have to turn it into a national holiday, why don't we now just start giving people $1,000 if they show up to vote also then? Turn it into the Roman Republic. It seems stupid that people would need an incentive like a national holiday to exercise this important privilege.
Charlie, thanks a lot for calling in. Philip, voting in and of itself should be enough incentive, Charlie's saying.
I think this is the sort of the fundamental issue that we are running up against, is that that's how a lot of people view this, is that it is a privilege, right? Or it's incentive on its own. And that's what political scientists have known for a long time. It's what we term the D term in the calculus of voting. It's the civic duty aspect. And civic duty is a major motivator for people. If you don't feel a civic duty to vote, you're fairly unlikely to vote. But it's not enough to overcome some very real costs for some voters. And I think that's the challenge, is how do we overcome those costs? I know he sort of tongue-in-cheek says we can pay people to vote. Obviously, not legal. Historically, we have done that. I mean, 1800s, we paid people to vote. It wasn't a great idea, but we did it.
Thanks a lot for the call, Charlie. We'll go to Jeff now in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, my opinion is rather complex. I consider myself a Republican, but like the previous caller, I consider voting a privilege, not a right. So my opinion is this. I am in favor of a national holiday because I'm concerned about the long lines I see when I'm watching NBC or CBS, you know, on election night, and they're projecting who's going to win. I'd like to see people have the day off so they could take the time they need to vote, but I'm also in favor of a national ID where it's on the responsibility of the voter to prove their citizenship. And if that means, using a driver's license or some kind of passport or birth certificate, then you have the privilege of voting. Because people in prison, they don't have the right to vote. So voting really is a privilege.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. So first of all, Jeff, concerned about long lines there and the voting, the day off for voting, the holiday he hopes might help with that.
Yeah, and I think he's right in that idea that because we don't see, in most cases, long lines throughout the day. We see them early in the morning when people first are voting before work, and we see them after work in the evenings before the polls close. These are the problems. If we can spread people out over the day, that would, in theory, reduce the lines.
And Jeff also talked about some kind of nationally recognized voter ID.
And I think I mean, this is a fairly common proposal among the Republican Party. There's not a lot of evidence that it actually reduces voter fraud, but it's a fairly common proposal that's put out there by the Republican Party.
Jeff, thanks a lot for calling in. Fawn joins us next in Madison. Fawn, hello.
Hello. Hi. I agree that it should be made a federal holiday because, although the previous caller said that voting is a privilege that should be celebrated unto itself, it's also a right and a civic duty. And to ignore the reality that some people have more privilege than others in day-to-day lives as far as their ability to take time off out of side of work and childcare and all their other duties to go and perform their civic duty, I think it should be recognized that this is a hardship for many people. And my hat is off. I deeply bow to the people who stood in long, long lines in places in the country where they could not easily vote, and where polls were, you know, there were too many people per voting place, and they stood in long lines. And this is an outrage, and we should absolutely make it easier for every person to exercise their right to vote. Thank you.
Fawn, thanks for the call. Philip?
Yeah, I think, again, this gets back to that idea of whether it's a civic duty, but I think what she brings up is the fact that there are disproportionalities in who is most able to take time off to vote, to go out and have their voice heard. And what that does is, if we believe that there are differences in political preferences based on those inequalities, that's going to be reflected in who's elected to office and the policies that get passed. And there's evidence that that is true, that there's generally what we call an upper class or a rich bias among the policies and the work that's being done on Capitol Hill. And in the sense that voting takes time and money and the ability to take time off, then we might see part of this being reflected in the composition of the electorate.
Fawn, thanks a lot for the call. Are these problems being solved, Philip, in the form of increased access to early voting, whether mailing in an absentee ballot or in-person absentee voting? Will this whole debate be moot because of all these other alternatives?
So it really depends on how those reforms are put into place. Absolutely, that is a suite of ideas and a suite of policies. Early voting tends to increase voting. The interesting work that's being done right now suggests that if you were to just implement early voting without any other reforms, that it actually can decrease voting.
Really?
Yes, because the idea is that there is a sort of a cognitive reminder of Election Day. And when you have all these other reforms that allow more access, yes, early voting helps. If you just say, vote anytime in the next 2 weeks, people lose that sort of cognitive anchor.
We need a deadline.
We do.
Okay. So as we wrap up, Philip, the House might pass something like this. Mm-hmm. The Senate probably won't. But do you think this is going to be the end of the debate or the idea of elections as a national holiday?
No, I think this is. I mean, we've seen this for decades as a talking point. I don't think the Democrats are going to let this one sort of go by the wayside. This was House Bill number one. There's a reason this is a symbolic piece of their agenda. In some sense, actually not having it pass is an even greater incentive for the Democrats to have another sort of electoral talking point. Not that they don't want it passed. I think they would love to see it passed, but there is sort of the silver lining to it not moving in the Senate is that it continues to be a big part of their agenda.
Philip, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Happy to be here.
Philip Chen is an assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. He joins today to talk about the politics surrounding a proposed bill that would make some significant reforms to voting laws in the country, including making Election Day a federal holiday. Still time for you to weigh in. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Health insurers often want patients to try the most cost-effective drug first before moving on to more expensive or risky therapies. These policies can prevent patients from getting the treatment their doctor says they need. Shemaine Mills reports how a woman in central Wisconsin struggled to get medication that worked.
For Samantha Espinoza, a long drive to the doctor from her rural home was one hurdle to getting care. Another obstacle was getting insurance to cover the therapy her doctor recommended. I went to visit her on a day so cold the snow squeaked like styrofoam. At the door, Samantha greets me with a warm smile.
Nice to meet you.
She looks healthy and happy, but it wasn't always this way. Espinoza suffers from psoriasis, a chronic autoimmune disease which caused red sores on her skin and damaged her self-esteem.
It was physically painful as well, but the emotional pain and now the ongoing scarring, that's something I'll have to live with for the rest of my life.
In 2012, Espinoza's doctor prescribed a newer biologic drug to control the psoriasis called Stelara. The drug can cost up to $30,000 a year. Her insurer denied the claim and made her try cheaper steroid creams first. They didn't work, and she still has a large tote bag full of unused medicine.
The bag itself weighs about 15 pounds. And I would go through one of these tubes every day to cover my body because I was at 80% coverage of the psoriasis.
The steroid cream to treat the scaly, itchy patches on her skin was so potent, her husband had to wear gloves when he helped apply it.
Seth would cover me in one of these tubes in my backside because I couldn't reach my backside. Every movement I made, my skin would break and crack.
The nightly 30-minute ritual wasn't done yet. She and her husband wrapped her up like a mummy in hopes the medicine would work better.
We would take saran wrap and wrap from my legs all the way up to right about my neck. So from the neck up, I was, you know, free of plastic. Everything else was covered.
It was uncomfortable, but she endured the hassle because she couldn't take pills covered by insurance. Her doctor said that medication, methotrexate, might cause liver damage. Senator Alberta Darling of River Hills is proposing legislation, along with fellow Republican Representative John Nygren of Marinette, that could help patients get the right medicine with fewer hassles.
So that one doesn't have to fail first before going on to the therapy that the doctor thinks is in the best interest of the patient, which is really, really important.
Those lobbying for the change include groups representing patients with costly conditions like arthritis, cancer, MS, mental health, and addiction. Angie Tees is with a coalition of 29 national and state groups that support legislation like this to reform what is known as step therapy. That's when a patient must try cheaper therapies first, even if their doctor disagrees. Tees, so far more than a dozen states have such laws on the books. Wisconsin's proposal would still require pre-authorization for expensive drugs, but there would be exemptions, and patients could get the drugs quicker because their insurer would have 24 hours to respond to emergency requests. If there's no answer during that time frame, Tees says the request is automatically approved.
So that's really important that we don't have a patient or a provider, you know, sitting out in rural Wisconsin or in metro Wisconsin, wherever it is, waiting for an answer on whether or not that person can get their medication.
It took years for Samantha Espinoza to get the right treatment. Her psoriasis is now under control because she got the medication her insurer originally turned down. But the need to keep medical costs in check came at a high personal price. She and others hope for a better way to balance patients' needs with skyrocketing prescription costs. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get reactions to last night's tonight's State of the Union address by President Trump and the Democratic responses, and you can join in with your reactions and questions. We'll check out a program in the Green Bay area that's helping teens and older workers develop high technology job skills. And if you're trying to find an upside to last week's polar vortex, here's a little something. Our guest says it may have hurt invasive bug species here in Wisconsin and ticks, too. That and more all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow at 6, meet a Wisconsin music expert who's been nominated for another Grammy Award and learn about the ethnic music traditions that helped shape the Midwest. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, from an estate tax repeal to an increase in the top tax rates, there's a wide range of ideas about the right way to tax the wealthiest Americans. Our guest looks at the different policy options on the table. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.